please tune in on Sunday at noon for it or listen on WBAI's archives. Another new program hosted by Maureen Langan is now at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, Badass Women. Please check it out. WBAI will be going into a week of fun drive programming on December 18th to ensure that we have enough funds to keep going. Know that we honor your suggestions and we try to implement them wherever possible. Please keep writing to me, pd@wbai.org, and please keep listening and supporting WBAI Radio. Thank you so much.
The time now is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. Nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches, enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
Oh yeah. Out of police cars. Leon Thomas there on vocals, Johnny Hodges, alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart, playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins. That's where I got the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. The Village Voice, where I worked for a few years, was known mainly for its writing and reporting. But I got to tell you, the only reason most of those stories got read was thanks to all the great photos that accompanied them. There were pictures that just made readers want to find out, what was this story all about? So The Voice became home to a small legion, actually, of really talented photographers whose pictures really came to define that old weekly newspaper. And it started with a guy named Fred McDarrah, the great Fred McDarrah, who for many years was The Voice photo editor. Fred was the guy who shot iconic photos of everyone from Bob Dylan and Andy Warhol to Jack Kerouac and Roy Cohn. Fred was everywhere with his camera. And Fred created his own kind of merry band of photographers who grew to include the marvelous Sylvia Plaatje and the great James Hamilton and a host of others. But My favorite voice photographer was Mark Asnan. Not just because Mark and I worked on a lot of stories together, but because ones that he made a whole lot better with his photos, but because Mark spoke the language of New York's streets and always enjoyed bantering with the rascals I was writing about and he had to take photos of. Mark did the photos for one of my favorite voice stories. It was a profile of a gangster named Doug LaChance, who ran the city's newspaper delivery union, the union that delivered the News and the Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Post. They had an outsized amount of power, although you never read about them in the pages because they were delivering the newspapers. But when I was at The Voice, I wrote that story, and Mark and I sat down with LaChance for a lot of interviews, and he was sort of this charming rogue scoundrel. And he would spin these stories for hours to us about gangsters he'd known in prison and the bosses of the Times like Arthur Sulzberger, who he knew personally. And You know, but underlying Doug LaChance's patter was a kind of a menacing tone that let us know he was perfectly capable of delivering a nasty beating to both of us if he didn't like the way he was depicted in the article. Well, Mark Asnan sat there, never batted an eye, and said he somehow got LaChance to pose and carrying bundles of newspapers, and then he followed him on his delivery route to get the best photo that ended up on the front page of The Voice when the story ran. Mark Asnan took those kinds of photos, the ones that no other New York City photographer had dared. One of his most famous was of the secretive and notorious Vincent Chin Gigante, boss of the Genovese crime family. He got a shot of the chin as he walked the Greenwich Village streets in a bathrobe with his brother, the priest, holding his arm. Then he ran for his life, I guess. I don't know. I'll ask him. And that's just the newspaper photos. Mark Asnan is a great photo documentarian. He did a book about his Uncle Charlie. It was on the life of Mark's kind of half-wise guy uncle. That it won a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. It won an Alicia Patterson Fellowship. And then completely on the other side of the coin, Mark also chronicled some of the last days of Menachem Schneerson, the rabbi of Crown Heights, acclaimed by his followers to be the Messiah. And then he stepped sideways again and chronicled the hard luck horse betters at the Aqueduct Racetrack in a book called The Big A. And he went on to take photos of the men who dig the graves at the cemetery and the would-be hoodlums hanging out on street corners. He just has a marvelous panorama. Mark Asnan, you're out there. Welcome to BAI. Thanks so much for being here. It's about time, right?
Thanks. Yes. Thank you, Tom, and all those great memories and those days at The Voice clearly shaped me as a documentarian, and look back on those days and all those wise guys and all those great stories that helped define me as a storyteller.
I bet it did. I did. It did. Listen, keep your voice up good and loud. Lean right into that phone or whatever you got.
Up there, buddy.
You know, someplace somebody wrote about you that you grew up in a Goodfellas world in Brooklyn in the 60s and 70s. Well, you want to? Is that true? You want to tell us a little bit about that world where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up on Neck Road, you know, which is a street in Sheepshead Bay. And, you know, everyone had an uncle, you know, who was connected. And you were in the schoolyard and, you know, you were in a fight with some guy. And, you know, he would tell you who his uncle or his grandfather was. And, you know, that was, you know, mostly myth and just the bravado. But you knew, you just knew it was that. Some would say the stench was in the air, but you knew, and as you grew up, you knew, you know, as you were getting older and you wanted to go hang out and have a drink. In those days, it was legal at 18, but you could try, you know, 15, 16, and but you knew you didn't go to certain bars because those were like connected guys, and it was just in the air. And, you know, many, many years later, when I started my Uncle Charlie project, when I was 18, you know, that dark secret of my mother's life came out, that my father was a connected guy, my grandfather. And in those days, you know, in the 20s through the 50s, there were a lot of Jewish gangsters. That's not a narrative the community wants to sort of embrace anymore, but you know, Murder Incorporated and Maya Lansky and all these guys from Brownsville, Brooklyn. And so, you know, that was in the air. And whoever thought I would wind up at the Village Voice, you know, photographing Doug LaChance and, you know, with you and Bill Bastone and, you know, other gangsters, you know, it's sort of, you know, what maybe it was meant to be. Or I think also at The Voice, you know, I was defined that I was one of the few photographers that had a Brooklyn accent. And I think Fred, even though I didn't learn much about photography from Fred, you know, what Fred did help me do was become much tougher. You know, he once told me, Asnan, you were a soft photographer when you got here. And I think he was right. And I think all those stories with you, Bastone, if it was gangsters, slumlords, corrupt politicians, helped toughen me up that later when I was making projects like skinheads in the Klan or kids hanging out on Irving and Bleecker and Bushwick, you know, that gave me the ability to do those kind of stories.
Well, you say toughen you up. You mean because you had to get right up there in people's faces and snap that shutter, is that it?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, you know, there were two ways to do it. Like, you could do it with a long lens, and that took a certain skill set, and I don't think that skill set came to me naturally. And I think there was something engaging. I mean, you know, no one ever saw me. I wasn't a soft person. I was definitely a kid from Brooklyn. And then when, you know, you were thrown out there in the street, like, with the slumlords, I think unconsciously there was something about intimidating them back.
Hmm.
So I was never soft as a, you know, a guy, but I was like, I didn't have that connection to my photography. But soon that became kind of my style or my approach, you know. So when you were running, you know, down the street after, you know, a slumlord, you know, there was something like, you know, payback. You were paying them back for them, you know, intimidating innocent people. And I think I enjoyed paying them back, you know, through journalism and having, you know, my pictures part of, you know, when I think those people that were being, you know, harassed and threatened, they didn't have a voice. And your stories and Bastone and other people at The Voice gave them that, and that all that connected to my later bodies of work. Like Uncle Charlie, you know, was someone, you know, we would say marginalized today, and mostly for his mental health issues, you know, where the story, the book I just helped put together on Death Row, you know, the final words of men and women executed in Texas. I think that all came from working with you guys at The Voice.
Interesting connection. You know, I mentioned the stakeout that you and Bill Bastone, the legendary voice digger and reporter, when you were, I mean, nobody had really taken photographs of Vincent Gigante. Everyone was looking at John Gotti in those years, you know, and nobody realized, oh, wait a minute, there's a much smarter, cannier mobster who lives right here, right in the smack middle of Greenwich Village. That took a little chutzpah, as they would say, on Neck Road, right?
Yeah. Or like, you know, chutzpah, or you were totally out of your mind. And like, as I told you, I had one rule with Bastone. And what I liked about The Voice, or my memory, is everyone went by the last name. So I was Asman, and he was Bastone, and you were Robin. There was Barrett in Newfield, and... So I won the one deal unofficial agreement we, Bastone and I, had was like, if it ever went wrong with these wise guys and you got thrown a beating or, you know, like that, I would never like call the cops, you know, and Bastone was like, you know, he would. And I'm like, yeah, listen, I love you, guy, but there I'm not going, you know.
And why was that, Mark Asman? You would not call the cops if someone threw you a beating?
Listen, that's the Neck Road. I mean, when I was in third grade, like, no one called the cops then. And I remember when I was in third grade, a guy two apartments down from me killed his second wife on a Friday night and shot her, and no one called the cops. You know,
okay.
Like, they knew it wasn't fireworks. So I think that was, you know, and my family wasn't doing anything illegal, but it was, you were afraid of, you know, like the repercussions of that.
All right. But
it never happened that way with Bastone. And, you know, but when you talk about, again, the chin and, you know, John Gotti was, you know, who everyone was covering, you know, to me, when I sat in that office on the newspapers and, you know, because I didn't have a desk, I was a freelance photographer, and just absorbing, you know, all of your journalistic knowledge, you know, again, you know, I don't want to be repetitive, but that shaped me to be the storyteller, how to figure out how to investigate, not the obvious, you know. And, you know, that all, I think you could see in my stories is I left The Voice and, you know, did my what we would call personal work. But, yeah, the chin was, that was a complicated story. You know, when Bill was, like, clearly the, you know, writer, reporter who knew more about the Gigantes and the Genovese crime family, we wound up taking out his townhouse on the Upper East Side. He lived on in a townhouse. That was given into him by this guy, Morris Levy, who was like a Jewish gangster who owned Roulette Records. And so we went up there. We were staking it out, figuring it out. And Bastone was the boss, you know. And, you know, I was petrified, so I borrowed someone's bulletproof vest. And, you know, and we... I was in, you know, I was with this guy, Eddie Borges, and he was, like, I think at that time a voice intern for Wayne Barrett. And there was a guy, Jesse Drucker, who's another intern, and he was with, worked for Joe Connison. But we were working as a team, and they were on Park Avenue and 77th Street, and there was some kind of, you know, when Bastone saw the guy who drove up, like, in a caddy to pick up the chin, his driver, Bastone would say something, scream out, and Eddie was supposed to, like, tell me, and I would then turn around and run at the chin, you know? And I think that was the second time we did it. The first time we did it, we just sat in a car, and there was a Greek diner around the corner. I must have went to the bathroom 100 times.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Being nervous. You know, and as I wore my bulletproof vest in and I had, like, my sort of chain with my press credentials, the guy was like, yeah, no problem, officer. Just use the bathroom whenever you want, officer.
Officer, right.
You know, like, what other lunatics wearing a vest? But I think that was the first time that didn't work out, second time. And whatever, you know, you look back and Eddie didn't hear the Bastone yelling and Bastone started screaming, and then I ran across the street. And when I ran, he was on the north side of the street. By that time, they got Chin into the car, and he was in his bathrobe. And it was we just missed it. But at that moment, one of Chin's sons, I think he had two sons, started chasing me down 77th Street, and I was just backpedaling the whole way. And he kept, like, threatening me, you don't know who the F I am, you know, why are you doing this to my father? And when I got to the corner of 77th and Park, he kept demanding, where are you from? And I, for whatever reason, I knew not to say. And I just kept telling him, listen, guy, I don't know who you are, who your father is, but no matter what, I can't tell you. And just the luck. My press card was always facing, you know, backwards, so he couldn't see. And after a few minutes back and forth with, you know, just telling him, like, my boss call, you know, playing the ultimate stupid guy, then he started apologizing. And he started telling me, I would have never hit you, kid. You know, I apologize. He's, like, kind of putting his arm on me. And you would never, we would never hurt you. And I'm like, listen, I'm never showing up again. I don't know who you guys are. Sorry for bothering you and whoever your father is. Ultimately, we got the picture because over a bunch of days, we set up two rental vehicles with cameras on these, like, small kind of, like, movable arms, and we had remote control, you know, like remote control slaves. And then when Chin came out in the morning, like he ever did, we got the picture of him. So it wasn't,
there you go.
There's another picture of him and Father G, but this was just him alone. And that was like, no one really had the picture.
There you go. Mark Asnan telling us how it's done. Stakeout. A lot of stuff is just stakeouts, right? Spending a lot of time just waiting.
Folks, yeah, this is a lot of
WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to photojournalist Mark Asnan, who's done some of the great work across the board of New York City streets and people for The Voice and for a lot of other publications. I'm going to ask him some other stuff about what he's done, but let me just remind you that this is the station that runs on the generosity of its supporters. And if you're, you know, on the edge of making a season's donation to this station, greatly appreciated. The pledge line is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950 to donate whatever you can spare, $10, $20, $50, or become a BAI buddy for this show or some other show that you like. Mark Asnan, let's talk about Uncle Charlie. That you did it for, what, 30 years? You chronicled his life.
Yeah, I started at 18, and, you know, different generations of documentary photographers look at different social issues, and in those days, and still today, somewhat less, it was always about poverty, you know, and, you know, this was Uncle Charlie, late 70s, early 80s. We, you know, he had lived through decades of poverty growing up in Bed-Stuy through the, you know, 77 blackout. So I started photographing him and his wife and his five children. And by the time...
What started you going on that? Was it because this is your mother's brother?
Brother.
What drew you to decide to do it? What made you think this is the guy I want to spend a lot of time focusing on?
Right. So when I was a kid, like, you know, we talked about everyone had an uncle who was connected. I had that fantasy. So if I had a fight with someone, I tell him my uncle was like a, you know, a tough guy. And he was. He was tattooed and he had guns. And it was very different role model, a male role model of my father. And he was a big guy. And if there was a problem, you know, with the guy around the corner, typically Uncle Charlie, you know, dealt with it on some level. Mm. When I re-meet him, you know, when I'm sort of, our lives intersect again, I'm 18, he's this frail man, bedridden, can't get out from the four walls. And he's the opposite of that, you know, of this, you know, wise guy that, you know, was part of my childhood fantasy on some level.
So he was no longer a tough guy. He was now someone you looked at and you said, this guy really has been beaten down in some way. And he was frail, you say, at that point, but still living in poverty.
Still living in poverty, but soon being there and observing, I realized this was much more, there was other layers that he wound up here. This wasn't just poverty. And then, like a lot of guys in Brooklyn or, you know, the Bronx, he was a good storyteller, and he weaved these stories. And a lot of, you know, when you're talking about stakeouts, like most of the time you're doing a story like Uncle Charlie, you're just there observing and waiting for these moments. And he would tell these stories. And I was in art school, and, you know, when other students were doing, you know, in a class called personal expression, and they were exploring their sexuality or things like that, I was exploring my family, and this guy who is now not what I remembered as a kid. And he was weaving these stories, and my mother would just say in a very frank way, like, listen, you know, my brother's nuts. That's just not the truth.
Mm.
But one day I came home and my mother broke down and said, okay, all that's true. I left it behind. I moved on into the life we live with your dad. But it was all true. So,
interesting. So that was the family secret. That sort of you said, wow, you know, this is something my mother's lived with, and here's the truth of it right here. Did you like Uncle Charlie? Was he a likable guy at that time?
I think at that moment, it was complicated because I saw the effects of, you know, the scars of his trauma then being put onto my cousins. So it was always like a love-hate relationship on, you know, when I was still very young. You know, it was a lot to process. So, you know, over the years I've had, you know, more empathy. You know, I have empathy for what he went through and how he never got what he needed, and, you know, he paid the price where his sister and other brother got out. Like, my mother had scars from it, but...
Drugs was a big part of Charlie's problem and his trauma.
Right. Charlie was very... He never did drugs, but he was codependent to women who were addicted to drugs, and he was very codependent. My grandfather was... you know, a severe alcoholic and barbiturate user or drug user. So it all goes back to my grandfather, Joe. So, like, Uncle Charlie then just took that codependency.
When you say codependency, I mean, what does that mean? It means he was relying on women? What is it?
He was relying, like, my grandfather made, you know, my mother and him do things. Like, my mother was a little Jewish girl. She had to run numbers. But she had to go to the Friday night fight. She had to go to Ebbets Field. She had to go to wrestling. Because even though he was a wise guy, today they would probably say he had panic and, you know, panic disorder, anxiety. Hmm. So Uncle Charlie had to go sit in the bars with him until 4 in the morning. He had to drop out of high school. And then that was the norm, you know, and in those days as today, people's mental health, especially, you know, when you're poor, there just wasn't that for Uncle Charlie to get help. So he just then, you know, found, you know, he became codependent with women who were, you know, had addiction. Hmm. But he never did drugs.
You know, so let's talk about some of the photos that really, you know, you can't take a picture of these great stories that he spun. But you depict him in a really chilling, telling way. You've got a photo of Uncle Charlie. He's sitting in a chair. He's looking out the window. You can see these tattoos that you were talking about, and he's hoisting this gun with bravado, as though, you know, I'm a desperado. And then there's another one. You have almost the same guy, and the gun is just dangling from his hand, as though, like, it didn't really mean anything to him. What was going on there? Do you have any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think on one hand, he was still wanting to live out the fantasy if he could have been still a wise guy. And he was still, like, you know, holding himself, you know, in his narrative, you know, even though he couldn't really get out of the house. In those four walls, he was still what he used to think he was.
Mm. There's another great portrait of him where he looks really gaunt and thin, but he's got kind of the wisp of a smile. He's wearing like a jacket, and he's in a room, and there's a photo of John F. Kennedy on one wall and a God Bless Our Home plaque with a picture of Jesus Christ on the other. You remember that picture and what was going on there?
Yeah, I mean, that was an early image that I took, and Charlie told me the only time he ever voted for president was in 1960. And that picture he saved from Life magazine, and that when they, you know, Kennedy was murdered that day in November, that was the end, like his dream. He lost his dream. Mm. But, I, you know, Uncle Charlie, you know, it connects, you know, to many things. Like, that day was not when his dream came to an end. Maybe for many Americans that, you know, Camelot was murdered, but, you know, he puts his life into things that he's read or experienced.
Right. There's another couple of photos that I just wanted to run through you. There's one where you got him sitting on the stoop of this graffiti-covered and bricked-up building, and he's smoking a cigarette. Where is that? Is this Bushwick? Where was he living at that point?
Yeah, he lived in Bushwick, 23 Troutman Street. It was this old series of maybe like three buildings, 12 apartments, all rent-controlled, rent-stabilized. And that's where he lived since 1969 with his children. And when he eventually couldn't go to work and he went from welfare to Social Security disability for mental illness, he kind of became the super, and it was owned by the church, this Lutheran church. And, you know, everything goes back to the voice, Tom, because at one moment they were trying to rip down the building to build an extension to the school, And he was like, you got to call those guys at the Boys.
And get them on the case. Stop them from ripping down
came.
My building.
Yeah.
You know, you carried one of the things that you wrote that Charlie told you, that he had no regrets about the way he lived his life and what he did. But he told you something about he'd probably meet you in hell. What do you think he meant by that?
I think my uncle understands that, which I think a lot of documentary photographers don't, or people who are looking at that, the interaction between the subject and the photographer, or it could be a writer, is that Charlie realizes that that project, that book, that shaped who I became and who I was recognized by far more than anything. And he saw that as that he got exploited. And I think that's for a discussion. Like, what I would say to him was, yeah, I wasn't the first guy that happened to. You know, we're not unique. You know, I mean, he's a narcissist, and he thought that was the only time that ever happened in journalism. But he's right. Like, the darkness of his life and everything he went through defined who I became, and that's one of the reasons I'm on your show today. But that's not unique to me.
You made it pretty unique. I think your project on your Uncle Charlie is, I mean, 3 decades of following a close family member through some very, very tough times, right up close and personal, is a remarkable achievement, Mark Asman. Let's take a break.
Yep.
Let's take a short music break. Reggie Johnson, you got that tune queued up, and then we'll be right back with Mark Asman.
I've no regrets.
No regrets, no regrets. I'm living the life of a king.
I've no regrets.
I've been in places on the end, yeah, and I've seen a lot
I've
of things.
No regrets.
Even when I'm sad, you can still hear me sing. Say that he calls me today. Well, I have no regrets for this life I live.
I've no regrets.
No regrets, no regrets. Now, how lucky
I've
can
no
I be?
Regrets.
And I sure hope, oh yeah, that you have love like
I've
me.
No
a happier person I know you'll never see. If it should be a say that he calls me today, I've no regrets for this life I live.
No regrets.
I've got
no
friends.
Regrets, no regrets.
And I got
no
my hair.
Oh, no regrets.
And I got love.
Okay, it's No Regrets by the late, great Little Willie John. I guess that's kind of obvious, but, you know, I saw that quote, Mark Asman, and something that was written about your Uncle Charlie project, and I always wanted to play that Little Willie John tune on the air, and
nice.
Thanks for giving me
nice.
The chance. I love that tune.
Absolutely.
And I started thinking, you know, as I was looking at your photos of him, about people who've lived their lives the way they wanted despite all the hard knocks that they took along the way, and I think that's the gift of your project, which really is remarkable. Let me ask you about some of the other stuff you did. You know, like, I'd forgotten that – was it an assignment from the New York Times Magazine that asked you to step up and shoot these photos of Rebbe Schneerson when he was still riding high in Crown Heights?
Yeah, it was an assignment, and you know, when I look back on all the big magazine, you know, or the assignments I did, that one probably stands out the most. And I think what, you know, got me that assignment was, like, my singular focus on Uncle Charlie for all those years. And they wanted me to make those kind of intimate, very close pictures of the Rebbe, you know, as he was called, you know, is referred to. So,
but the Rebbe is considered the Messiah. How could you ever get access up close to take those photos?
Right. So the whole Messiah, so, you know, most people would think, you know, that Hasidic Jews don't want to be photographed, and that's only for certain sects. So let's say the group that lives in Williamsburg, which is predominantly Satmar, they don't want to be photographed. But the community, they're known as Lubavitch, but also known as Chabad, they embrace, the Rebbe embraced the use of technology. So photographing in that community wasn't unheard of. For many years, he didn't want people photographing him, his own community, because he thought it was a distraction. And it's not clear still to this day if the Rebbe thought he was the Messiah or not. You know, there was like then and still today, there's a loud minority, and that's sort of how it keeps that.
I saw in my walk over here a big poster up on a lamppost that said Messiah is here with a picture of Rebbe Schneerson. So even though he's been gone a long time. But I'm just, I mean, you have some remarkable pictures that are on your website, Mark Asnan's work. And one of them, it's almost like the Last Supper. You've got Rebbe Schneerson at the pulpit, I guess, or what you would call it. And it's this really, really crowded room, and you could just see these long-bearded, dark-coated men with their hats hanging on every word. A couple of guys are slumped onto the rail in front, and then there are these kids peering in from behind a window, and another kid looks like he's under a desk or something, and you're right there taking that photo. You remember the shot I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's an incredible... You described it really well, Tom. It's this incredible moment of... It was on the fifth anniversary, the fifth Yahrzeit of the Rebbetzin, which is the Rebbe's wife, on her passing. And he gave this speech. And, yeah, I never saw such passion in a synagogue or, you know, there's thousands of people in the room. And everyone's just focused and pushing, you know, the intensity was something I never experienced as,
it's like they forgot you were there.
Yeah, they forgot everything, and it was just an incredible moment that I was able to record, you know, but that moment was, you know, what the Rebbe created. And the other thing about photographing the Rebbe, you know, when people, you know, it's new to them, the Rebbe, like maybe you could think of the Pope. I mean, he's not the head of all Jews in the world, but in his community, and his Hasidic sect, and the incredible intimacy, you know, the closeness that, you know, on morning prayer, I could be, you know, a foot away from him when he was reading from the Torah, just said something to me about how the Rebbe was so secure of who he was and the community or the people, you know, around him, the Rebbe's secretaries, the people, these other rabbis who, you know, had different roles in his life. That was incredible. You know, I mean, that he was doing his thing and I was doing my thing. And years later, people, you know, would say, oh, you know, we saw you, we remember you photographing the Rebbe and we couldn't believe how close you were. And that's sort of when that's what the New York Times Magazine sent me to do. And that's what I did. And I would say to people, oh, did you think that was disrespectful? Just wondering. And they said, no. But no one ever did that.
Hmm.
You know, so I think that's who the Rebbe was.
The photo they used for the front page of the Sunday magazine for that story, it was a large headshot of the Rebbe. Am I right?
Right. It was on, the Rebbe was famous for something called Dollar Days. And on Sundays, people came from all over the world, and they would stand online for a blessing, and they would get a single dollar or a few single dollars. And the idea was he was giving you charity, tzedakah, and that you would then go out in the bigger world and give more tzedakah. You would, you know, you would pass not on those dollar bills, but you would go out and do mitzvahs. And part of that is, you know, for Jews are ultimately waiting for the Messiah, and the more good deeds you do, one day the Messiah will come. So that I took many, many, you know, on one given Sunday, I went back specifically to focus on a cover because I mostly didn't. I had to use a different kind of lens, and I had to shoot vertically. And Kathy Ryan, the director of photography, chose that image, and she also was the one who found, you know, you would say, you know, the Final Supper, and you described the picture. It was a, sort of like a Dutch painting. And,
yeah, it really
you know,
is.
And Kathy, I think, understood, you know, the reason she sent me was that singular focus on one individual.
Yeah. Well, it's such a complicated community. I cut my teeth in the early 80s writing about buildings they were emptying of people who weren't like them and driving them out into the streets because they wanted to fill them with Lubavitch and their schools and everything. And I never saw such, you know, callous treatment of people. And yet here you are in the middle, as you said, of this incredible, passionate thing. I mean, it's a world full of contradictions, difficult to understand. But the photos that you took really sort of helped put us there. It's a great job.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I sort of felt the same way looking at your photos of Aqueduct. You know, I forget what brought you out there? What was that? Was that just you? You just wanted to go to?
No, I originally did a story for New York Magazine about winter horse racing. And, you know, I spent like 2 days there and, you know, there are certain assignments, you know, you get and, you know, you're attracted to on a deeper level. And over like, you know, somewhere between 7 and 10 years, I would just go back on and off and, you know, make portraits of these, you know, these guys who were mostly supposed to be at work and, you know, they weren't at work and they had accents like me or, you know, then when the immigration, you know, like years later, immigration changed and there were different accents. Right. But what they all sort of had in common was they loved the gambling and most of them weren't gambling in a healthy way. And, you know, as in Uncle Charlie, I recorded them and I, you know, in the book that I'm hoping to be published in about a year, you hear their voices. And I think that's the other thing I learned at The Voice is that when you guys were interviewing people, I took that and Uncle Charlie in the book, Uncle Charlie, he tells his own story. Hmm. The interviews over the 30 years are edited into a narrative. So it's a collaboration, you know, and I think in the Big A, you hear these like hardcore gamblers, some of them sadly kind of degenerate gamblers. Tell their story, and
well, the photos. The photos just depict. I mean, it's the middle of the winter, and you can see by the way people are dressed. But the stands are not just half empty. They're like, you know, people are just sitting all by themselves there, and there's just this forlorn aspect to it of these folks. You know, like even the couple of winners don't look like they're that happy, right? I mean, it was such an interesting scene, you know, that you captured, and yet that's, you know, was a crucial part of New York. You know, between, you know, there was Belmont where all the you know, the upbeat players went during the season, and there's Aqueduct where the serious bettors went to try to make their plays. You know, and you really captured that.
It's a place of broken dreams, and you know, like you know, when you can't really get ahead, and the city's changing and gentrification, and you're left behind.
What about the grave diggers? How'd you get to the cemetery?
My mother was connected somehow to the president of the Grave Diggers Union.
Wait a minute. Connected how? We've been using that word. What do you mean?
Not connected like that.
Okay.
My mother worked later in life in an insurance company in Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Okay.
And,
all right.
You know, my mother definitely had the gift of gab and, you know, like.
Oh, that's where you got it. Okay. All
right. I got it. Yeah. Uh-huh. My mother always wanted to be a poet. It didn't work out. But
your mother wanted to be a poet. Oh,
yeah.
Really?
So,
did she write poetry, Mark?
She wrote when my father had to change his career. She would write my dad every night when he came home and he had breakfast. She wrote him these poems. They were all corny and literal, but it was something to give my father hope, after he sort of lost the career. And my dad sacrificed everything, and he was a photographer when I was a kid.
Huh.
Commercial photographer, and that didn't work out, and he gave up his you know, his dream, and then he let me live my dream. So I was very fortunate in life that my dad was able to do that, and you know, that was a huge influence. But my mother somehow knew the guy, and the guy met me, and I was 19 years old out on the Interboro Parkway, where the highway cuts through the cemetery.
Sure.
And I was just, you know, and listen, I think in a lot of these places I kind of fit in because I had an accent. You know, I wasn't, you know, like even though I went to art school, I wasn't, let's say, the stereotype of, you know, maybe in a, like I don't think of myself as an artist. I think of myself as a storyteller. But yeah, I kind of fit in, and during, you know, those cold days or hot days, those guys would, you know, have me sneak beer in or, you know, bottles of liquor, and, you know, I kind of fit in with them. And, yeah, I mean, that was a long time ago, and, you know, all those stories, you know, learned a lot through them, and, you know, helped me, like, Grave Diggers, all, you know, those stories of the kids, you know, on the corner in Irving, you know, in Bushwick.
Yeah, how did that start, Mark? You took some very
tough photos.
There
was a murder
for
the first time in Thomas Jefferson High School in East New York. A kid got killed in a school by a gun, someone shot him, and Stern magazine wanted to do a story about guns and youth.
Stern magazine from Germany.
Yeah, okay. It was like their version of Time magazine, right. And I had worked for them and pitched a story to the New York Correspondent, and we spent 12 weeks unearthing in Bleecker. Can't believe now, like, probably can't afford to live on Irving and Bleecker. It's so gentrified.
12 weeks, that's a long time.
They paid
30 years, but still, that's a big investment.
Right. They paid for 3 weeks and 3 weeks of day rates and 12 weeks of expenses. And I got that. I was able to connect with, you know, those kids on that corner because of the kid who grew up on Uncle Charlie's block. And, you know, in those days, Irving and Bleecker was predominantly Puerto Rican. And this kid, Eric, took me over there and told him I was a good guy, and he knew me his whole childhood. And, you know, just spent weeks, and it was a story, yeah, you know, about, you know, kind of young broken dreams or, you know, slinging drugs. And
yeah, you've got pictures of people selling drugs, doing drugs, waving guns around, you know. I mean,
right.
These kids are okay with that.
Yeah, listen, you know, it's the 15 minutes of fame, but also one of the kids once told me that, he said, "You're doing the wrong story, guy." He said, like, it's easy to take pictures of Puerto Ricans on the corner and you have us all with guns, but the real story is the Italian guy selling us the guns. Mm. But they're smart. They're not stupid like us. They won't let you do that story. You know, so when, you know, listen, I think today when you look back, I think it was an important story. It was the story of the time. But it also, you know, it was the easier story to do. You know, maybe Stern could have been doing the opposite of.
Well, it's a real story. You know, the other one comes with a lot of obstacles. you'd be right back to doing those stakeouts like you did for Chin Gigante, to try to capture them. Mark, you want to? What are you working these days? What, is there any long term projects that you've dug into that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, I think my life has evolved, and, you know, I'm no longer a magazine photographer because that way of earning a living disappeared, you know, and even though magazines are on the internet, they have no more advertising. So I've changed, you know, because I still had kids and got to pay the bills, you know, but, you know, the connection to personal work and telling the stories of people that needed to be heard. So years ago for Stern magazine, I had an assignment and we did like mentally ill people or who were on death row. because for the Germans, it wasn't, you know, they don't have the death penalty. So they wanted a more specific story and something that sort of never left me with the writer in Louisiana interviewing a Cajun prosecutor. And the Cajun prosecutor said, you know, in his, you know, distinct accent that you, that this guy we were interviewing about was an animal and he had to put him down. He had to put, yeah, got to put those animals down. And the German writer was very soft-spoken, said, oh, yes, like Hitler. And he said, oh, man, are you, like, comparing me to Hitler? And the writer said, no, of course not. There's only one Hitler, but you share the same mentality. And I realized that day the intersection of the dehumanization of people on death row and in this country disproportionately, you know, people of color, that is a Jew, that this is something I know, you know, from what happened to my people, you know, through the Holocaust. And years later, I came across that the state of Texas, there was public access to the final words of men and women from the death chamber in Texas. And first time around, I wasn't successful, but after many years with the help of CUNY, Queens Community College Art Gallery, I was able to get the funding, and CUNY helped me put together, you know, I worked on putting a book together with the University Press of Kentucky, and this November, the book Final Words was published, and it's 578 men and women executed, or more appropriate, their final words. And I think those, who better to make the rebuttal against that dehumanization than the people that the state of Texas tried to silence?
You know, you were kind enough to give me a copy of that book, Mark Asnan, and it's a doorstopper. It's a heavy, big book, but it's like double truck, as we'd say in the news business, with facing pages. And on the left side, there is the details, the personal details of the prisoner, and with his name and life and serial number and tattoos and circumstances of his conviction and whatnot. And then on the right side, usually very brief, the prisoner was asked to say his last words, and then there they are. I mean, it's a remarkable assemblage. I mean, it's really stark. I mean, it's not photographs, but it comes along with the punch of, had something to do with that, I guess.
Yeah, I was, you know, as a friend of mine doesn't like, I put in the back, I was the idea guy, so.
The idea guy.
I just saw that. I thought, you know, I think it all goes back to, you know, Uncle Charlie told his story through interviews at the Big A, and I thought here that they should be able to, those final words should never disappear. And, you know, in Texas, you know, maybe someday they take those more, they don't make those final words, you know, easy to, you know, today they're on a website. Maybe tomorrow, you know, with their vengeance, you know, how they see the world.
Is there a website, Mark Asnan, where people can actually see at least a portion of what's in this giant book?
Yeah, I mean, hold on. They can go to finalwordsdeathrow.com. Again, that's finalwordsdeathrow.com. And there's, you know, excerpts from the book and some videos and information about, you know, what the state of Texas is doing. And there's some, there's a very important essay by Kevin Cooper, who's been on death row in Texas, in San Quentin, California. Mm. And he's been working on wrongful conviction for over 38 years, and Kevin Cooper.
Hey Mark, in our last 30 seconds, tell us, you know, we talked a lot about the Uncle Charlie book. Are copies of that around? Can people find that online, the Charlie
book? Sure, you can go on Amazon, and there's Uncle Charlie, and you can also find on Amazon, The Final Words, and all the proceeds from The Final Words, you know, what would be the author's royalties, go to an organization called ECPM that fights against the use of capital punishment around the world.
All right. Hey, you covered some tough stuff, Mark Asnan. You're a long time out there in the streets shooting stories that other people would have missed, let alone spend the time you did. We got to go, but I want to thank you so much for being here. And
thank you, Tom.
And taking the time.
All those guys at The Voice. Without that experience, forget about it.
We got
to
leave it there. Thank you, Reggie Johnson, engineering, and thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments of this show with Oliver Nelson's Stolen Moment. Take care, everyone.
I'm Paul D'Arienzo with these headlines. The Department of Justice announced the arrest of a top United States diplomat in what's being called the longest-running infiltration by a spy in United States history. He allegedly spied for the government of Cuba. Attorney General Merrick Garland made the announcement.
The department has charged former U.S. Ambassador to Bolivia, Victor Manuel Rocha, with illegally acting as an agent of a foreign government. This action exposes one of the highest-reaching and longest-lasting infiltrations of the U.S. government by a foreign agent.
Rocha worked for the State Department from 1981 to 2002. He was on the National Security Council from 1994 to 1995 and was an advisor to the U.S. Military Southern Command from around 2006 to 2012.
The complaint alleges that Rocha sought out and used his positions within the United States government to support Cuba's clandestine intelligence gathering mission against the United States.
The government claims Rocha admitted to an undercover FBI agent over the past year that he spied for Cuba. Rocha was expected to appear in court on Monday. And on Monday, the Israeli military said it killed a top Hamas commander in an airstrike on a refugee camp outside of Gaza City. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Red Crescent reported one of its volunteers were killed in northern Gaza, while CNN reported that nine members of the family of its producer, Ibrahim Rahman, were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Sunday. About 60 journalists have been killed since the war broke out on October 7th. It's about the same number of journalists killed during the entire Vietnam War. Hamas on Monday dismissed allegations by Israel and the United States that its fighters raped women during its attack on Israel. In a news release, the group says the allegations were a desperate attempt to distort what Hamas claims is the group's humane treatment of Israeli hostages. And National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan blamed the recent outbreak of hostilities on Hamas's refusal to release those women hostages.
Right now, Hamas is refusing to release civilian women who should have been part of the agreement. And it is that refusal by Hamas that has caused the end of the hostage agreement and therefore the end of the pause in hostilities.
Well, State Department spokesperson Matt Miller says women hostages aren't being freed by Hamas because they were raped.
One of the reasons they don't want to turn women over that they've been holding hostage, and the reason this pause fell apart, is they don't want those women to be able to talk about what happened to them during their time in custody. Certainly, there is very little that I would put beyond Hamas.
But Max Blumenthal, editor of The Gray Zone, says Israel is the real war criminal and the rape allegations are a fraud.
To address the sense of trauma and insecurity of the Israeli public, Israel's waged an international psychological warfare operation through the media, leveraging any possible claim that they can make stick about Hamas atrocities in order to make it seem like Hamas burned babies in ovens, gang-raped women on video.
Max Blumenthal of The Gray Zone. According to the Gaza Ministry of Health, the death toll since October stands at more than 15,200 Palestinians killed, including 6,150 children and 40,752 wounded in the Gaza Strip. 256 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. And in local news, congestion pricing is coming to Lower Manhattan. An extra toll on vehicles that use streets that have been congested by traffic for decades. Cameras would snap pictures of license plate numbers and send a bill of about $15 to motorists. Certain roads would remain free, including the FDR and West Side Drive. East River bridges would also remain free. The plan is meant to raise more than $1 billion for the city's transit system, but some advocates say congestion pricing will actually bring more air pollution to some of the poorest parts of Lower Manhattan. Former Lower Manhattan Council member Catherine Free says it's a 1-2 punch since demolition began on East River Park for a flood control project last year.
The one area that's really getting screwed on congestion pricing is us. We're getting higher pollution, higher congestion, and we're still getting higher prices.